Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, John Russell, Steve Ember, Morris Joyce, and Frank Oliver. But first, this report from Brian Lynn.
Swiss researchers have developed a machine that they say can keep human livers alive outside of the body for 1 week. Current technology and methods are only able to keep human livers alive for up to 24 hours. The new machine is able to keep the liver active by performing several functions normally carried out by the human body. Researchers say they expect the technology to greatly increase the number of livers available for transplant. This could save the lives of many patients suffering from severe liver disease who need to have their liver replaced. Scientists from the University of Zurich in Switzerland developed the machine. They recently reported their results in the publication Nature Biotechnology. The researchers say the purpose of their Liver for Life machine is to perform what they call liver perfusion operations outside of the human body. Perfusion is the process by which blood or other fluids are pumped through organs and tissue. The machine keeps the liver at the right temperature and moves it in a way that would be natural in the body. It uses a pump to fill the liver with blood, acting like a replacement for a human heart. The machine also provides oxygen to the organ, controls red blood cell levels, and removes waste. A healthy liver is necessary to support life. The liver receives about 25% of blood from the heart and carries out about 5,000 different tasks in the body. Livers are among the most commonly transplanted human organs. Most transplants involve patients suffering from severe liver disease or cancer. The Mayo Clinic in the state of Minnesota reported that in 2017, about 8,000 liver transplants were performed in the U.S. among adults and children. Of those, 360 involved livers from living donors. In addition, about 11,500 people were registered on a waiting list to receive a liver transplant, the organization said. Keeping livers alive and functioning for longer periods could greatly improve the chances of survival for patients. The research team began their experiments using livers from pigs. After repeated testing and engineering development, the team said it was able to get the pig livers to survive for 7 days with support only provided from the Liver for Life machine. The scientists said they also discovered that the system can work to repair damaged livers. In one test, the team connected the machine to 10 injured human livers that had been rejected for transplantation by all European medical centers. After 7 days of perfusion treatment from the machine, Six of the human livers fully regained important liver functions, the researchers reported. Pierre-Alain Clavien is chairman of the Department of Surgery and Transplantation at University Hospital Zurich. He helped lead the research. The success of this unique perfusion system, developed over a four-year period by a group of surgeons, biologists, and engineers, paves the way for many new applications in transplantation and cancer medicine, helping patients with no liver grafts available, Clavien said in a statement. He added that the successful treatment of poor quality livers could lead to a wide range of new treatment possibilities. Such treatments could be used to repair pre-existing liver damage, remove fat from the organ, or even recreate partial livers. The team is now planning its next step in the development process. It is making preparations to transplant machine-treated organs into patients. I'm Brian Lynn.
All her life, Elham Balatone wanted to play soccer like her brothers. However, in Sudan, where she lives, women could be arrested and beaten for putting on soccer clothing in the strict Muslim country. She played anyway. "There's nothing in this world that I love more than soccer. Please let me play," she said she told her family. For years, she and other women played secretly, until now. Recently, Sudan's sports minister watched the women play in a sports center in the capital, Khartoum, where the country celebrated a new official women's soccer league. Even Balatone's family was happy about it. "The new league is about more than a game. Sudan is trying to move away from 30 years of leadership that followed Sharia, a strict understanding of Islamic law that limits what women can do. Officials are making changes after the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. In November, officials canceled a public order law that, activists say, had been used to discriminate against women. But not everyone is happy. Some extreme religious conservatives are pushing back. Preacher Abdulhay Yosef and others have said permitting women to play soccer will destroy religion and morals. What manhood would allow a Muslim woman to appear before men with her arms, legs exposed and then run before them? Yosef asked religious followers in October, just as the league began. He also said Sudan's Minister for Sport and Youth, a woman, doesn't believe in what we believe in. He called her an apostate. This has resulted in legal action between them. Another pro-Sharia group called on preachers to expose the government's secularization plots. Critics argue that some conservatives are using the methods of the former president, al-Bashir. They say he criticized political enemies, using religious language to control women and stop change. Yosef's words have not affected the league. But Takrid Owada, an official for one of the teams, said the argument was a part of the greater fight for change. Owada said to have a women's soccer league play in Sudan destroys the world al-Bashir created. Under al-Bashir, laws that controlled women and their clothing targeted the poor, uneducated, and political activists, Owada said. Women players were usually left alone if they played quietly, although one group of women was arrested for a short time. Now the moment has come when they can show people that women could play just like men, said Amani Anas, a player for the Al-Tahadi team. The players said there is no conflict between their religion and soccer. I'm Susan Shand.
''2019 was a good year for sport utility vehicles, or SUVs. Rising demand for SUVs drove record sales for German carmakers such as BMW and Mercedes-Benz. But some observers worry that their popularity could lead to more pollution from such vehicles and a reduction in the environmental benefits of electric cars. BMW reported last week that it sold a record 2,168,516 vehicles last year. The Reuters news agency says the record resulted, in part, from a 21% increase in sales of the company's X model SUVs. These models now make up around 40% of BMW's sales worldwide. At Mercedes-Benz, the world's best-selling premium car line, every third luxury car sold last year was an SUV. To try to meet stronger pollution rules, many automakers are investing a lot of money in electric vehicles. But it is unclear how many drivers will buy them. The International Energy Agency, or IEA, warned in its World Energy Outlook 2019 report that large SUV sales could create a problem for the environment. Consumer preferences for SUVs could offset the benefits from electric cars, the report said. It added that SUVs are more difficult to electrify fully, and conventional SUVs consume 25% more fuel per kilometer than medium-sized cars. SUVs were the second-largest contributor to the increase in carbon dioxide emissions since 2010, said the IEA. Carbon dioxide is found naturally in Earth's atmosphere. But many scientists believe that it and other gases released by human activities are to blame for rising temperatures on our planet. There are now more than 200 million SUVs around the world, up from about 35 million in 2010. If the popularity of SUVs continues to rise in line with recent trends, this could add another 2 million barrels per day to our projection for 2040 oil demand, the IEA reported. BMW and Mercedes owner Daimler say their vehicles are among the most fuel-efficient available. They add that people could also choose to buy smaller,
less costly cars instead of SUVs. Both German car makers say they hope to set new sales records this year. They are preparing to launch fully electric SUVs, which they say shows their desire for a cleaner future. While confirming the growing popularity of SUVs, Germany's powerful automobile industry group VDA said much of the demand was for more efficient models. Electric and hybrid vehicles made up only 3.9% of new European sales in the three-month period from July through September 2019. Peter Fuss, a partner at Ernst & Young, said German carmakers pushed sales of SUVs last year before stronger clean air rules took effect in Europe. "We will not see the same growth rates in this segment as we did last year," Fuss said. Electric car registrations are expected to climb in the middle of this year, he added. "But that will depend on drivers being prepared to buy them, and perhaps also on how low manufacturers are prepared to cut prices." I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation, but administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the Federal Treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, "The people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations."
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often, their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, "If my men starve in the streets of Washington, The smell of their bodies will force Congress to act. Coxey tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxey, were arrested. A judge found Coxey guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxey's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet, the economic and social pressures which created Coxey's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay. Yet, Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses. Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So, railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them. And no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.